second part of the session on implementation. And we've got two great people who will be able to tell us not only about theory, but also about experimental work, in both cases in optics. So the first talk is he is the Canada Excellence Research Chair in quantum nonlinear optics at the University of Ottawa, which is one of the fantastically prestigious chairs here in Canada. And he's also the winner of the 2016 Charles Townes Award by the Optical Society of America. So we congratulate you on that.
Okay, thank you.
While he was still alive, I was once with Charles Townes in Buckingham Palace. It was on the occasion of the award of the Templeton Prize to Martin Rees, Lord Rees, and Charlie Townes and a number of other Templeton laureates, and in his case also Nobel laureate, were there at the gathering. We were waiting for Prince Philip to come and present the prize to Lord Rees. And a band struck up out of the window. And we wondered what that was, and we were in the Japanese room in Buckingham Palace, which is the room behind the balcony on which the royal family appear for big occasions, like the Queen's birthday a few days ago. And we looked out of the window, and the reason the band was struck out was because it was the changing of the guard, which is quite a sort of splendid British ceremony. And there was a vast crowd gathered around Buckingham Palace to watch the changing of the guard. And Charlie Townes thought that he'd like to watch too, so we opened it. You can see what's happening. He opened the French windows and stepped out onto the balcony, you see, and one or two others followed him. And the crowd couldn't believe their luck, that royalty appearing on the balcony. So all the crowd waved at Charlie Townes, and he made the mistake of waving.
Next time we should go like this.
At this point, Prince Philip's equerry grabbed hold of Charlie and pulled him back into the room. And I said to him, "I'm sorry, you'll probably lose your job for this." And he said, "I shall deny all knowledge of it."
Okay, so thank you for that introduction. Just one more Charlie Townes story. I was a student of Townes, by the way. So it was doubly meaningful for me to win the Townes Award because he was my advisor. In fact, I got the award just 10 days ago in California. Thank you. When Townes was alive, he used to sometimes give the award himself. But he passed away about 18 months ago. But I got Mrs. Townes to come and present the award to me. So it was just one of the really big things of my life. But getting back to the Buckingham Palace story, right after that happened, Professor Townes showed me this photograph. And I said, "Hey, who's that scruffy looking man standing next to you?" He said, "That's Prince Philip." I said, "Well, tell your buddy that he needs a haircut." Okay, so I'm really honored to be invited here with the incredible collection of other speakers. I also offer an apology. I really do not believe in coming to a conference and only staying for a couple of days. I usually don't. This week, I just plain had to. There were thesis defenses, and I just couldn't tell my students that, no, going to this conference is more important than your graduating. Okay, so I call this some topics in quantum photonics. And the reason is I have four topics somewhat related. First of all, I'm going to tell you about ghost imaging. You'd say, why would I care about ghost imaging and what does that have to do with quantum fundamentals? Well, because then I'm going to tell you about interaction-free ghost imaging, a topic that is of great interest to many members of this community. Changing gear a little bit, really experimentally oriented. We've discovered a new photonic material that is hugely nonlinear, and this may have some very important implications for quantum technologies. And then if there's time, I'm going to tell you how to do quantum key distribution in which you carry many bits per photon. Now, let me remind you, the internet works by sending one bit using many, many photons. I want to send many many bits using one photon. So it's maybe it won't work very well. But as a conceptual point, I think it's just fantastic. Okay, so let me tell you about ghost imaging. This is a story going back a number of years now to 1995. I mean, it's cute. Whether or not it's important, that's a topic for discussion. But here's the idea. You have a laser beam, it excites a second order nonlinear crystal, parametric down conversion occurs, an entangled photon pair is created. One pair hits a photodetector array, and just by quantum uncertainty, the photon may hit one or another or another or another of the pixels on the array. The other photon interrogates some object that you want to image. If the photon passes through the object, the bucket detector goes click. It's called bucket detector because it collects everything in this half plane. If it absorbs the photon, then the detector doesn't go click. You put a coincidence circuit here, and you look at the photodetector array in coincidence with this detector going click. And in the early days, we were very happy that we could image stencils of the name of our university. But in recent years, this has really been, this is a mannequin, not a person, but I mean, that you can have things that look like realistic images. So maybe it works. In the very early days, a controversy sprung up as to whether this is a purely quantum mechanical process. I said these photons are entangled, but the conceptual question was, what if they were just classically correlated? Would it still work? Common sense says yes. But that doesn't keep some people, you know, during the McCarthy era, we Americans were looking for communists behind every tree. So in the early 21st century, everybody's looking for quantum effects, but it's clear that they are not quantum effects. So a group of very good friends at Boston University published a paper that said, this is a signature of quantum behavior. And Gatti, Brambilla, and Lujato didn't criticize them directly, but said, well, if you want to tell whether this is a quantum effect or not, if you can do imaging in both the near field and the far field of the source, that is a quantum signature. If you have entanglement in both position and momentum, that's the basic idea here. So John Howell and I decided, hey, let's do this experiment. Let's really pin down when ghost imaging is quantum and when it is classical. So first of all, we did an experiment using quantum entanglement. I won't go through all the details, but we generate two entangled photon pairs by choosing where we put our lenses, what is imaged onto what. We can look in either the near field of the parametric down conversion source or in the far field of the source. Here is the object we are looking at. It's just three transmitting slits, and both in the near field and the far field, we can form a good image. Then we repeat the experiment just by using a classical correlation, the most trivial type of classical correlation. We have a beam splitter here that rocks back and forth. And by rocking back and forth, we can aim the light in different directions. And the way it was set up here, we saw the strong correlations in the far field, but very, very weak correlations in the near field. So this validated the Lujato claim that with quantum, you can do imaging in both the near field and the far field, but with classical, it could be in one or not the other. Next advance in ghost imaging, again from the group of Gatti and Lujato, was to point out that you can do ghost imaging even using the correlations that are present in thermal light, such as Hambury-Brown twist types of correlations. So they point this out. And let's recall that the intensity distribution of thermal light looks like a speckle pattern. This is the instantaneous intensity, assuming you can do a measurement in a time scale short compared to one over the bandwidth of the light. I mean, for sunlight, that means 10 to the minus 14 seconds, probably not going to do it. But with a very, very narrow band thermal light source, maybe you can do it. So this is the trick that we used in our studies and many other people use in our studies. We use pseudothermal light. We create a speckle pattern with the same statistical properties as thermal light by scattering a laser beam off a rotating ground glass plate. Tito Verrecchi started this late 1960s. So here's how the experiment works. Laser beam hits a rotating ground glass plate, beam splitter. Now, this is classical light now, so you have identical intensity distributions here and here. Of course, with quantum light, you can't say that you have identical distributions, but for classical thermal light, same intensity distribution here and here. Here's the object you want to measure. Here's the CCD camera. And you look in correlation once again. What's the intuition for how this works? Well, in the reference arm, you have an imaging detector, and you actually record what the speckle pattern looks like. Let's say you have a very simple object, just this small transmitting region, and this is statistical. So on every realization, the speckle pattern looks a little bit different. On different realizations, a different fraction of the light is going to make it through this opening. You take each one of these, you multiply it by the measurement you got here, you sum over many, many realizations, and the ghost imaging works. Now, why is that important? Well, at one time, people could get money from their governments to do this. Why is it important? Well, the claim is that by decoupling the imaging part of the system from the interrogation part of the system, it gives you some potentialities in terms of doing imaging under robust conditions. But I think what's really where this may become important is what we call two-color ghost imaging. New possibilities are afforded by using different colors in the object and reference arms. So you could imagine either thermal ghost imaging or quantum ghost imaging. Quantum is more plausible, I think, because it's really hard to make a speckle pattern that's identical to two different wavelengths. And if they are, once they propagate a little bit, they will no longer be identical speckle patterns. But for the quantum ghost imaging, you just take your nonlinear crystal, you tilt the crystal just a tiny bit, and suddenly instead of being degenerate, the two output wavelengths are different. So this could be important because let's say you want to form an image of an object and there is no CCD camera or any imaging device that is available at the wavelength at which you want to work. So you do the detection at a wavelength where the camera works well, and you interrogate the object at the wavelength in which you want to study the object. And a number of people have done this. Most recently, Miles Paget and I combined forces on this to form an image. We illuminate the object at 1550 nanometers, but the other photons at 460 nanometers, where the device works, the camera works well at 460 nanometers. The idler is at 1550. The idler illuminates the object that we want to measure. Now, there is an experimental subtlety here. That's that you want to look in correlation or in post-selection here. We use an ICCD camera. This is the sort of camera that you can gate. You can open up the shutter for just a very, very short amount of time. That's just incredible. Why is this? I'll tell you why it's incredible in a minute. But the trouble is that there is like 100 nanosecond delay time here. So you send it the signal pulse, but then you have to wait before the camera is ready to take the picture. Just like on your iPhone, you press, but the picture doesn't get taken immediately. So you have to put the image on hold. So we bounce the image back and forth through a image preserving delay line, and well, here it works. So this is what the object looks like at 1550 nanometers, although the data was collected at 460 nanometers. Now, just even though this is a theory, even though this the Perimeter Institute is for theoretical physics, I think there's something going on in experimental physics that is important enough that theorists should know about this. we now have nearly ideal CCD cameras. What would I mean by an ideal camera? I mean a camera would have 100% quantum efficiency and a vanishing dark count rate. Now, intensified CCD cameras, the one I was just telling you about, have a quantum efficiency of only about 20%, but they can be gated. And by you gate not only the signal, but also the dark noise. So it's essentially dark count free, because you're collecting dark counts only for these brief moments of time in which the detection window is open. The other type of camera is an electron multiplied CCD camera. Well, these are technical issues. This camera can have a quantum efficiency of 90%, but it does have background. It's only 0.2 counts per pixel per readout, but they're like a million pixels in the camera. So you have a number of pixels that are firing at random. If you send a single photon to the camera, you don't know which of these clicks is from the photon you wanted and which are from the dark counts. So they complement each other. And well, Miles Padgett and I have done some investigation of this. So this was the summary. Here are the details. This is one paper that we wrote, but this shows that an entangled light source can have strong correlations either in the near, both in the near field and in the far field. You all knew that, but we did this with a camera. People traditionally have taken a point detector and scanned it through this intensity distribution, and they spend hours collecting data. Here we have a camera that is sensitive enough that we just take these pictures directly. And same thing with ghost imaging. So this is with the iCCD camera, and once again, we needed this delay line. This shows that we can do ghost imaging of a ghost. This is Miles' sense of humor, not mine. We can do ghost imaging of a ghost.
But is it ghostly?
Yeah. Ghostly. Yeah. Like lighter shade of pale, but we'll get back to that. Some people love to see their names up here. So I checked earlier. Nobody in this audience has their name here. There is a fairy, but he's not the infamous fairy. It's spelled slightly differently. Okay, so now that was sort of just introductory comment. Now, interaction-free ghost imaging. So this is work by Frederic Bouchard. Frederic is in the back. Ebrahim, myself, and Harjapreet Mand, who... It's very sad when somebody smart enough to be a physicist wants to become a medical doctor. But these things happen in life. What are you going to do? Let me back off a second and just make maybe a conceptual point here. Let me ask, what constitutes a quantum measurement? Let's say you have a single photon, and let's say you know with certainty that's a single photon, and you have a beam splitter, and you have an ideal detector, and the detector goes click, and that means you know with complete certainty that the photon photon exited this port of the beam splitter. But now, if the photon does not go click, then you know that the photon must be here. I'm not the first person to realize the subtlety of quantum mechanics, but there are times in quantum mechanics when a non-measurement constitutes a measurement. So put that one on hold. Now, there is a proposal by Avi Elitzer and Lev Weidman, long number of years ago, on how to do interaction-free measurement. Here is Andy White's rendition of this in an imaging context. Here's how quantum imaging by interaction-free measurement works. Let's say you set up a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Initially, this arm is just entirely empty. Yeah, you understand. This arm is entirely empty. You adjust the path length so that all of the light exits here, none of the light exits here. You now block this arm, and suddenly the destructive interference that prevented light from exiting here gets taken away, and suddenly light appears. Suddenly, a quarter of the time, light emerges out of this port. In a sense, this is a real paradox, because you know the opaque object was here, but you know that the photon didn't hit it, because being opaque, the photon would have been absorbed. And you know the photon was absorbed because it appears here. So how in the world did the photon know that that the object was there? You're sophisticated in the audience. I won't tell you the answer. I think you sort of caught on. But then Andy White and Paul Quiot said, well, we can do imaging this way. You set this up, but then you take a very small object and you form a microscope focus here, you translate the object through this focal region, and then you can map out the transmission profile of a wire in one case and of a slit in the other case. So then we started thinking about this and said, hey, you know, there's a conceptual question here, and this is one that that's worth thinking about. Let's do interaction-free imaging using entangled photons. So here is the idea. We have two spatially entangled photons. One comes here and falls onto a photodetector array. And let's say that the beam is large enough that this beam of light pretty much fills this photodetector array. The other photon enters the interferometer, and now you have a small opaque object. It is smaller than the transverse size of the beam inside the interferometer. Of course, there are lenses that I won't show because it just makes it more complicated. Now, if this detector goes click, it means that this photon actually hit the small object. So it localized this photon. Question is, whether does this photon get localized or not? Well, you could argue either way. So we're asking the question, does an interaction-free measurement constitute a real measurement? Or if you like the language of the collapse of the wave function, not everybody likes the language, but at least we know what we mean, so I will continue to use this language. Does an interaction-free measurement lead to the collapse of the wave function of its entangled partner? Or maybe more precisely, does the entire two-photon wave function collapse when you do an interaction-free measurement? So we set out to do this, and we have results, which I'm going to show you in a minute. So the experimental setup is actually not so different from the conceptual one. A frequency tripled neodymium laser, parametric down conversion in BBO, interference filter. We split the two entangled photons. One goes here through a delay line. One goes here into the interaction-free interferometer. Again, the delay line is here because we look in coincidence, and it takes a time for the CCD camera to turn on after the pulse arrives at it. And here's the object that we can put here or not put here. So, and here are some of the results. And this is still preliminary, but I think pretty much believable. So here's the interaction-free ghost image of a straight wire. So here's the wire, and you see that there's some background, and we are fighting in the laboratory to try to get better results. We've had this for a couple months now, but Ebrahim keeps insisting that he wants to do better, and I shouldn't show the data until he can do better. I said, well, Ebrahim doesn't do better. Well, I don't have time to do better. Okay, so I'm showing you this data right now. So in singles, we get a big splotch. In the coincidence, we get some background, but the narrow splotch. So this answers the question. Indeed, an interaction-free measurement does collapse the wave function. The distribution in this plane here gets narrower when looked at in coincidence with detection for the interaction-free measurement. So this result shows that interaction-free measurements lead to wave function collapse, just like standard measurements. Now, I would be proud of myself were it not for the fact that I have to ask, was this even worth doing? We could, instead of simply ask the theorist, there are a bunch of theorists here, we could simply have asked a theorist what the answer is going to be, and they would have said, well, of course it's going to happen. There is very little doubt that this is what the output was going to be. But my response is that physics is an experimental science, and theoretical models are developed to explain the results of experiment, not vice versa. So I thought it was worth doing to see if interaction-free measurements do constitute real measurements in this sense. In fact, Elitzer and Weidman, in their original paper, said, assuming that the detectors cause the collapse of the quantum state, this is my emphasis, not theirs, but I think they were cautious to say that, hey, there's a real question as to what the outcome of such an experiment would be. Okay, the second question is, different question is this useful? Well, I think it could be. Interaction-free imaging allows us to see what something looks like in the dark. Think about that. Something like the retina of your eye. The whole idea of the retina is that it changes its character when light hits it. Okay, so it's very easy to tell what a retina looks like when it's illuminated by light. What does a retina look like when it's not illuminated by light? And similar questions in biology, where you really want to minimize the amount of exposure you give to an object. In fact, in a sense, now that we've done the conceptual point, maybe this is where the work is heading, is to do some biophotonics based on this concept. I've already told you what we did. No sense going here. Let me instead go to this slide here, which sort of summarizes the field of quantum imaging, or maybe I should say ghost imaging. So this was the original ghost imaging of Yanhuashi, which I talked to you about already. This is the interaction-free imaging of Andy White, of course, using Lev and Elitzer's idea. In this talk, I combined these two to give interaction-free ghost imaging. But something else very exciting happened a couple of years ago, and is still ongoing right now. This was work of Anton Zeilinger's group, in which he does imaging with undetected photons. So you have a nonlinear downconversion crystal here. Let's say it creates a red and a yellow photon. The red photon passes through this object, then it and the pump goes through a second nonlinear crystal. Now, there is no way of telling whether any individual red photon came from this crystal here. There is complete lack of knowledge. What they do is then put a dichroic mirror. They throw away the red light. So only the red light interrogated the object. They throw away the red light, but there is transfer of coherence. This is like Mandel's induced coherence experiment. This is the imaging version of Mandel's induced coherence. And they get an image here. They get an image here with the green photons, even though the red ones were the only ones that interrogated the object. The red ones are not even detected. I guess that's the difference between this and this. Here you detect both photons. Here you even throw away the photon. Okay, so I have... right, so I will just go on to... We will skip this one here. New photonic material. But I think more than telling you about the new material, let me tell you why I feel this is important. So we want all optical switches that work at the single photon level. And we need photonic materials with a much larger... In order to do this switching, we need photonic materials with a much larger nonlinear optical response. So here I'm going to tell you about a new material with an N2 value that's 100 times larger than any previously reported material. And this appeared in Science magazine about 6 weeks ago. So, but let's still step back. What makes a good Kerr effect nonlinear optical material? Well, you want N2 to be large. N2 is this coefficient telling you the change in refractive index is N2 times I. But you also want the maximum change in refractive index to be large. And So they're different concepts. First of all, if the material has a damage threshold, you just can't keep increasing the intensity. Second of all, certain nonlinearities saturate. So in both cases, there is a maximum change in refractive index that you can obtain. For silica glass, this delta N maximum is in the third or fourth decimal place. But for the new material we report, the maximum change in refractive index, do I have it here? Is 0.8. So delta N is almost unity in this material, and N2 itself is extremely large. So I like to think, of course, that this could be a game changer for the field of engineering photonics. How does it work? Well, the new material, it's not a new material, it's a very old material. It's indium tin oxide, but people had not connected the dots, as we say. Indium tin oxide is a degenerate semiconductor, meaning it is so heavily doped as to be metal-like. It has a high density of free electrons. It has a bulk plasma frequency corresponding to 1.24 microns. And actually, it's very well explained by the Drude formula. This is undergraduate physics here, that the real part of the dielectric constant goes to zero when omega is equal to plasma frequency divided by the square root of this number. So this is called the epsilon near zero region. There's been a huge amount of interest in this region. All of the intuition about electromagnetism is different if the refractive index is zero. Right? Waves don't propagate anymore. They oscillate, but they don't propagate. So it just throw your intuition out the window. So we got some ITO. And we measured the real and the imaginary part of the dielectric constant using an ellipsometer, and we find that the real part does vanish at 1.24 microns. But okay, what is the connection? Well, why is it that epsilon near zero is important for nonlinear optics? Well, if you go to your favorite textbook on nonlinear optics, you will find that there is a relationship between N2 and chi 3. Let's consider chi 3 to be the material parameter describing the material, and let's consider N2 to describe how the material responds to light. And you see that there is the refractive index times the real part of the refractive index in the denominator here. So whenever the refractive index is very small, you get a huge increase in N2. And I mean, that's a lot of why this works. There's another effect as well. If you apply the boundary conditions on Maxwell's equation, so this is the ITO, you find that for P polarization at non-normal incidence, the field inside the material can be very much larger than the field outside the material. So these two effects both contribute to making a huge nonlinear optical response. So here is the data. These are Z-scan measurements done as a function of wavelength. Here's the N2 value plot as a function of wavelength as we increase the angle of incidence. So you see we get this very, very strong resonance structure centered at the epsilon near zero wavelength, and an increase of factor of 1,000 or so above what this is in the wings. Same thing for the imaginary part of N2. So then what do we do? So then we say, well, let's go to higher intensities. Let's go to intensities as high as 250 gigawatts per square centimeter. And we find that the nonlinear response saturates. But you see something very, very surprising if you've never thought about this. R is the reflection from the surface. T is the transmission. A is the absorptance. R is the Fresnel reflection coefficient. It's unprecedented in nonlinear optics for the change, induced change in refractive index, to be so large as to change the Fresnel reflection coefficient. But it was here. So we had to develop a propagation code to figure out what the real and imaginary parts of the refractive index are. And you see the real part of the total refractive index now does this. The imaginary part actually gets a little bit smaller. Gets a little bit smaller. Change in the refractive index is 0.8. So, but could it be useful? So then we measure the response time. And the response time we measure to be 360 femtoseconds, which is large enough to support a switching rate of 1.5 terahertz. So here are the implications, and I think my time, actually I had 45 minutes, didn't I?
Yeah, I would. So let me just finish.
So these are the results here. So what's exciting? Well, the usual chi-1, chi-3, chi-5 interpretation of nonlinear optics breaks down. So we can have fun reformulating the whole field of nonlinear optics, and there's some new effects. Wave guiding, you can actually, the change in refractive index is so large that you can literally have one beam of light refracting off another beam of light. So a lot of potential applications here. And I'm not going to do this, but I will go to my joke slide. This falls in the category of commercials that the organization wished they had never made public. Okay, thank you.
That's been interesting, because you said that this interaction free measurement allows you to image things to see what they would look like in the dark. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of wondering if that's true or not.
So, me too, but I think it is.
So here's a didactic experiment.
Yeah.
So imagine you have a ghost, mm-hmm. So an image of a ghost like you have, except that the moment any photon passes by it, it changes shape and it turns into a pumpkin, let's say. So the question is, would you see, so in principle that's possible in quantum theory, mm-hmm. that a photon passing by it or infringing on it would cause the shape to change. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, would you see the ghost or the pumpkin when you did the imaging? And that's a theoretical question.
Yeah.
My guess is that you'd see the pumpkin, mm-hmm. if I took things a bit more carefully.
Oh, okay. Let's remember how the. Well, Avi, this is your theory, not me, but maybe you have a.
No. I'm sure that I share with Weizmann the feeling of two parents who see their child just growing beyond their imagination, doing things that they don't understand, because some of the things that you say I don't understand. But I would like to assist Lucian in making the question perhaps more accessible. You mentioned the object being opaque. It doesn't have to be opaque, because you either measure whether it is there or not,
sure.
or measure mm-hmm. whether it can do something. So how about the following? Usually when you make interference, you make the two mirrors screwed strongly to the table and to the lab. So none of them can tell you whether it was kicked by the photon. Just loosen one of the mirrors such that it can receive momentum from the photon. And that's it. So something turning into a pumpkin. Is that correct, Lucien? Would that help you? Or
you have a recoil.
Right. See, right. Just see. And then you see that if it suffices that it did not get a recoil, it did not block the photon. It just told the photon you never went here, but it didn't block it, which makes it a bit more. This is what Pedro said.
So are you saying
okay, yeah, I agree.
Ghost or
bumpkin? Kind of.
What we're saying, Lucien, is there might be a recoil of the mirror if the photon had gone there.
Right.
All right, so that would then change the momentum of the mirror.
Right.
Well, those are great questions. So, of course, when you do it the first time, you do the simple one.
Yeah.
And it'll take me longer to learn how to turn a ghost into a pumpkin.
Yeah, you have the question, by the way, all right? When I'm talking with Yakir, I often have this feeling that it's like a close-up magic conjurer, and he's sort of distracting you from what you really should be looking at. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, so keep going. With regret, please keep going.
So when Anton says undetected photons, mm-hmm. it's not really undetected photons at all. It's just that you transfer the information from the photon that interacted with the object to another photon, then you detect that one.
Yes.
Well, that's not quite as special as the slogan suggests, all right? Now, can mm-hmm. you help us with some of these other things here? You say we're going to image an eye where the light doesn't go into the eye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's the conjuring trick there? And what should we really do?
Here's what I really think. 3/4 of the time, you're not going to do it. 1/4 of the time, you're going to get an image of the eye with a photon that did not get absorbed by the eye. So I mean, that is the trick, is that it's probabilistic.
Yeah.
You don't every time do it, but I tend to believe these people. I mean, it seems ironclad that if the photon ends up, well, let's say it's opaque.
Yeah.
If the photon ends up here, it did not get absorbed by the eye.
But now if our requirement is that the eye is not affected by incident photons,
mm-hmm.
we fail right. that criterion as far as the overall investigation goes.
There's an H interaction. There's an interaction Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
No, let's agree. Interaction-free was maybe not precisely the word, but there is an interaction Hamiltonian. Okay.
First, I completely agree with Ali. I never thought about this idea, so it's new, new twist. I think it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Asking about Lucian, answering Lucian, I think you'll see the effect. But if it's not opaque, mm-hmm. then I will not claim that it's interaction-free. So, but when it's opaque, I believe it's really interaction-free, and not just in this classical meaning in which if it would go there, you will never find it. This is not good enough. This is classical thinking, but I think it's not acceptable. But there is another meaning that it's interaction-free. If you make this measurement, there will be no trace whatsoever of your photon near the object. This can be tested if you repeat this experiment many, many times.
If with weak measurements or something.
Weak measurement, whatever. It's really in this way, the interaction, you can write all kind of Lagrange or whatever. I think the good criterion to know if the particle was there or not, if it left any kind of a trace. And the photons in this experiment near the object, if it's really opaque, will leave no trace whatsoever. So I think it is.
Same with
so I would agree. I mean, well, that was what I was claiming. Yeah.
Left?
Yeah.
Same with a recoil mirror. A mirror can recoil and it does not recoil. Would you not say, and then you have the interference destroyed. Wouldn't you not agree that this is also interaction-free?
I think it's more problematic. It's not as clear as it's not as clear.
Okay, one last question.
Hypothetical. As an experimentalist, if you were trying to detect, say, a femtometer change in path length on the upper arm, would that collapse? Do you think you could detect that at some point in your technology to the point where you would see a collapse of the wave function if there were something, a small path length difference?
One part of my brain and another part of my brain are being torn. That sounds like weak value amplification. Is how I would measure something that small. So I have to think. I have to think. But since Lev knows the answer,
question from Lev, just one sentence answer.
Just you make quote from this: assume that there is a collapse in the detector.
Okay.
This is worse. The meaning of
my answer is I have to think.
No, that's what I want to do next door.